Chapter 4. No doubt the vaunted general is confident he knows all that is required to outfight and confound his enemy. No doubt the enemy opposing him knows exactly the same thing. Codex Astartes. The Generatorium dominated the west of Port Memnor, its exhaust stacks and cooling towers defining the cityscape. The enormous cylinders of the generators were clad in age-stained rockcrete, crisscrossed with gantries and cranes. The blocky shapes of the turbine were halls, covered with industrial Gothic flourishes, insisted on by the city's imperial founders. Shanties crusted around the base of the buildings, nestling precariously on the banks of open industrial sewers. A short distance away was Port Memnor's spaceport. Enormous hexagonal landing pads served by hundreds of fuel tanks and control towers. Hidden beneath the pads, beneath enormous hydraulic hatches, were the defense lasers that made the spaceport such a valuable asset for the Imperium to take control of. It would allow large spacebound ships to disgorge their complements of Imperial guardsmen and tanks. Then, taken to Agrellon itself on faster armor transports that could weather ground fire from the Tau advancing across the planet. But there were xenophiles everywhere, including among the thousands of men and women among the crews of the Generatorium and spaceport, and the Imperium could not land its ships until the traitors were rooted out of Port Memnor. In the heart of the Generatorium complex was the personal domain of Magos Skepteris. It was into this web of dark chambers and corridors that the small party from the Thundercliff tribe were admitted, among them the old woman who served as their elder, and a number of men and women inducted into the tribe's mysteries. They carried tribal fetishes. The shed snakeskins and staffs cut from the trees watered by the bloodshed in the beast pit beneath the cliff, and were escorted through the labyrinth of Skepteris's lab complex by a detail of peacemaker troops. Pictors followed them. Their operators carefully shadowed the peacemakers. They were not permitted to film details of the complex unnecessary to the broadcast. They passed by the strange exotic machines for generating and transferring strange forms of energy, the crackled fingers of electricity between their polished brass spheres. Magos Skepteris waited in her receiving chamber, a room barely ever used, for she was not a diplomat at heart. Banners hung displaying the heraldry of the priesthood of Mars, and an altar of pure carbon blocks was stacked up by one wall, with an icon of the half-skull and cog that was the symbol of the Mechanicum.
"Is this necessary?" said Skepteris, as the delegation filed in.
She glowered at the technicians aiming their pictures at her.
"The gesture must be seen, if it is to serve," said the Thundercliff Elder, "or it will be as if it had never happened."
"Very well," said Skepteris.
"You will need to let blood," said the Elder. "Just a little. Blood is essential. Without it, there could be no bond to the earth of Briseis."
"That will not be a problem," said Skepteris. "My pain centers have been replaced with data storage."
"Then we may begin," said the Elder.
The pictors began to whir as the delegation surrounded Skepteris in a robe circle. She was draped with garlands of braided snakeskins, and the Elder pronounced a ritual in the native tongue of Briseis, the language with which its tribes had greeted the imperial founders of Port Memnor. One of the ritual attendants rolled up the sleeve of the Magos's robes, and, finding one of the few areas of skin that had not been replaced with data ports or radiation shielding, drew blood with a long golden needle. Drops of it were poured into a bowl, made from an animal skull, and the Elder sang, the attendants taking up her song in the same sibilant language.
"Briseis is cruel, said the Elder, now in low Gothic as the singing continued.
Briseis thrusts us into her stony world and takes us out just as suddenly. But in the time between, she gives us the greatest gifts. Minds that we may understand. Hands that we may create. Souls that we may join them in brotherhood. And she is not jealous. One may enter her embrace that was not born to her cruelty, to partake of her gifts, yet not suffer a birth into the plains of slate and the forests of beasts. Blessed indeed is such a newcomer, and exalted indeed. This honour Briseis extends to Magus Scepteris of Mars, priest of the Adeptus Mechanicus, and through our hands she welcomes her.
The Pictors focused in on Scepteris's face, which was still half hidden by the cowl of her red robes. The ceremony paused, and the ritual attendants turned to Scepteris expectantly. Scepteris glanced between them and the lenses of the Pictors, and seemed to realize that a speech was expected of her. Not being used to such things, she had not prepared anything.
"I thank you," she said flatly. "The Adeptus Mechanicus thanks you for this honor."
The silence that followed indicated that Scepteris was finished.
"Then from this moment," said the Elder, "you are a member of the Thundercliff tribe and a child of Briseis."
The attendants unraveled a bundle they had brought with them, revealing it to be a large expanse of animal hide, scaled and craggy with barnacles, exuding a strong smell of brine and faint decay. This mantle was draped over Scepteris's shoulders, swamping her with its size and heaviness.
"Sister," said the Elder, placing a hand on Scepteris's mantled shoulder.
"Sister," said Scepteris.
The Pictors zoomed in on the pair, and the ceremony was complete. The xenophile corpses had barely begun to turn cold when the broadcast began. Sergeant Cianoa had led his squad in at the first vox, suggesting the safe house location, and had shown no pause or mercy. The safe house was three floors, two below ground, none free of corpses. They lay shredded by bolter fire, or carved clean open by chain blades. Killed in the bedlam of a predator's feeding frenzy, the battle trance that came over the jade dragons when the fight turned to wanton butchery, and their way of war permitted abandonment of tactic and restraint. The Ultramarines could not fight like that. Their Codex Astartes did not acknowledge that Space Marines were predators, as surely as the ravenous hunters that drifted between the stars. It was a fine book, certainly, full of generations of battle wisdom. But it was not the whole truth of war, the truth the jade dragons knew. Cianoa was on the upper floor, the one that resembled a worker's dwelling with several rooms of bunks and communal kitchens. The jade dragons had fallen on the people here as they had everywhere else. Those living there, as camouflage for xenophile activities, were as guilty as the xenophiles themselves, and had been exterminated. Torn bodies and severed limbs littered the floor, and the instep deep blood rippled with the footsteps of the jade dragons moving around on the lower floors looking for survivors. Outside, the street was overlooked by one of the district's many enormous screens, which broadcast civil information, prayer services, and the recent exhortations to report xenophiles and suspicious activity. The screen was covered in a mesh of thin bars to protect it from missiles thrown by disgruntled citizens, and as Cianoa passed by the window, the screen lit up. It showed the image of Magus Scepteris, surrounded by citizens in the dress of one of Briseis's tribes. The ceremony proceeded, and Scepteris was enrobed and pronounced a member of the Thundercliff tribe. Finally, the Magus was draped in the skin of the Black Leviathan.
and Seer Noah of the Jade Dragons understood at last what he was on Briseis to do. Captain Davinius stood over the body of Brother Thaxos, lit by the harsh lights of the glow globes in the transport hub. The back of Thaxos's head was gone, the cranium missing behind the line of the ears. His face was mostly intact. His eyes, ruptured red by the bolter's detonation, had been closed. "All the Xenos on Agrellon are not worth a single ultramarine," said Davinius. "Especially not Thaxos. His blood is on the hands of the Watercast, and on those of every Tau. If we did not have anything to avenge upon them before, we do now." The rest of Davinius's squad stood around the bench on which Thaxos's body had been lain. The body's armor had been removed, revealing the old scars of his augmentations and the new ones of battle. The squad had no apothecary to remove Thaxos's gene seed. The body would have to be transported back to the chapter for the organ to be taken out, ready to be implanted into a novice, and for the flesh of Gilliman to pass on again.
"If you wish to speak freely, brothers," said Davinius, "then now is the time. I give you leave."
"It was not a way for an ultramarine to die," said Brother Venarin. Venarin had snapped the prisoner Kersioth's neck a second after the fatal shot had been fired.
"And our mission has gone awry since the moment we landed here," said Brother Silen. "The massacre, then this. And the Jade Dragons are not allies, I trust. We do not even know where they are right now, save that they are somewhere in the Chrono Rites district doing throne knows what."
"Then we take the initiative," said Davinius.
"Thus does the Codex Astartes state. We do not react, we act. The mission continues as planned. The early stages have not gone as they would, but the next will bring the Emperor's will to Port Memnor. We cannot bring Thaxos back, but we can avenge him with victory. The war effort on Agrellon relies on us. We shall not let them down."
"Pray, brothers," said Silen,
who by unspoken assent was now Davinius's second in command.
"Take your own words from the Codex and the rites of Macragge. Search your own soul for the armor of faith and the sword of hatred. But pray, for soon there will be no time for words."
The members of Davinius's squad knelt one by one around Thaxos's body as Davinius shrouded the body in a corpse sheet. They all murmured their own prayer, some to the machine spirits of their war gear, some to the long-dead heroes of the Ultramarines, some to the Primarch, Rabute Gilliman himself. All of them asked for victory. All of them asked for revenge. The loss of the outpost in the tombs had been a blow, but it had been prepared for. Such assets were not essential, and in cases of aggressive persecution by an enemy, could be considered disposable, obstacles for the enemy to overcome before he could make real headway. It was part of the Watercast's way of silent invasion, always evading instead of coming to battle, giving the enemy just enough to draw him on and commit his resources, without making headway into the core of the subversion strike force. A far more important installation was hidden among the shanties and rat-trap habs that adjoined the Chrono Rites district, far from the affluent districts around the palace. It was concealed among the labyrinth of hab blocks, its entrances accessible only through camouflaged firing positions. It was not armoured, for its defence was secrecy, and it was not heavily staffed, because numerous personnel would be a liability and not an asset. It was crewed by a handful of Watercast interrogators and emissaries, an honour guard of 2 Firecast warriors, and a complement of Briseis's most dedicated and trusted Gwela. The hateful imperial term for these loyal humans was xenophile, but the Tau took pains to educate them that they were valued and respected converts to the greater good.
The shanty facility was the more important of the two major bases in Port Memnor. The conversion of the city could be achieved without the Firecast facility, but not without the intelligence base the Watercast had built down amid the poverty that had turned so many Briseans to the greater good. Behind a disguised blast door at the back of a particularly filthy and ill-omened shanty, the salvaged boards and plastic sheeting gave way to the gleaming purity of Tau architecture. Two of the Xenos moved down a narrow corridor, past the choke point covered by a pair of gun drones mounted in the ceiling. One was a Watercast ambassador, the same who had met with the Thundercliff Elder in the tombs beneath Port Memnor. The second was a Firecast warrior, a Shaz Vray in command of this mission's Firecast complement, squatter and more powerful in build, wearing combat armor, and armed with a rapid-firing pulse carbine slung at his side. The knife of the bonded Talisera was inscribed on his shoulder guard, marking him out as the leader of a squad whose members had sworn to fight and die together by the greater good.
"I fear," said Ambassador O'Mayan, "his mind has been picked clean. I have envoys working on him day and night. He will not last much longer." "If you have indeed mined him dry," said Vray Sire, "then should the effort prove too much for him, we will not have lost anything much."
"True," said O'Mayan.
"What is it you hope to find?"
"Anything that would be useful to us," said Vray Sire. "Space Marines require a particular form of warfare. They are rarely encountered, and survivors to debrief are rarer still."
"Then have at it," said O'Mayan.
A door slid open to reveal the interrogation chamber. O'Mayan's envoys were monitoring the equipment keeping the captives alive. Most of them were Imperial spies, or Port Memnor dignitaries, kept for what they knew about the defences and society of the city. An Earthcast technician worked the controls of the medical gear, and one of the dozen captives shuddered in his restraints as stimulants and metabolic balancing agents were pumped into him. The captive's eyes snapped open, and he stared down from his cage on the wall, convulsing with the effort of being woken once again.
"Our data indicates that this is an older specimen," said O'Mayan. "A lifespan extended with their rejuvenation technology. They are so obsessed with their lifespan, these creatures. It is one of the many factors that makes them exploitable. They fear death so. Without the greater good, there is nothing to fight for save for another day alive."
"They all look the same to me," said Vray Sire.
The captive's eyes focused again, and the confusion on his face was replaced with despair.
"Is it the day?"
whispered the captive, his voice ruined by the tube in his throat.
"The day when I am to die."
"What is your name?" asked O'Mayan.
"Throne be damned, you know my name,"
gasped the prisoner.
"What is your name?" asked O'Mayan again.
"If you do not answer, aversion stimuli will be applied."
The prisoner's head hung.
"Thelso Denier," he replied.
"Are your rank?"
"Lord Archivist of the Librarium Penitentium on Morkrut."
"The Lord Archivist here," explained O'Mayan, "was quite the coup for the second phase expansion intelligence corps. It seems we are more effective at sifting through the bureaucracy of the Imperium than the Imperium itself. The knowledge he has absorbed over a lifetime of labor is often lost to the Imperium at large. Thus, in some respects, we know more about them than they do. Lord Archivist, tell us of the Codex Noctis Verminion."
The archivist's head lolled to one side and twitched.
"It is accessing the data implant in the back of its cranium," said O'Mayan.
Its purpose was a mystery when this one was first processed. Thankfully, it was not removed immediately.
The Codex Noctis Verminion presents a history of the hunt for the Infinity Worm,
began the archivist,
led by Lord Inquisitor Trentis Venn and...
The Jade Dragons, said Vray Sire.
Two battle companies of the Jade Dragons Space Marine chapter were present,
said the archivist. A drop of blood ran from his eye down one cheek as the strain of repeated accessing of his data vault continued to damage his nervous system.
Led by Captain Nufaleo, the Huntsmaster.
Their way of war, said Vray Sire. Their weaknesses. Will they fall prey to the patient hunter or the killing blow? The seven spears? The final shadow? Speak!
Fast assault and shock tactics,
droned the archivist.
Evidenced by the landings at Fedoran IV. Suitable for morally deniable operations. Ecclesiarchal oversight denied. Suspected deviant ritual faith.
The archivist coughed and spat gobbets of blood down his front, splattering the clean floor.
I can be certain you know everything the archivist has divulged about the Jade Dragons, said O'Mayan. They were a subject of the first interrogation cycle, especially when it became apparent knowledge of them was not available in the Imperium at large. And then the Ultramarines, said Vray Sire. Among these creatures, said O'Mayan, the Ultramarines are preceded by great fame. You will be here some time, Shazray.
The archivist spooled out tale after tale of the Ultramarines. They concerned endless battles, tactics first written in the Codex Astartes and preserved in fragments the archivist had crammed by their thousand into his data vault. O'Mayan had no interest in them. He had plumbed the archivist's mind for everything he cared about. The way the Ultramarines thought, the weaknesses among their beliefs and worldview. Humanity had been conditioned to think the Space Marines invincible and without flaw, but they had more than enough failings to be exploited by a veteran of the Watercast. Pride was among them, as was their adherence to the Codex Astartes and the teachings of their long-dead Primarch, Rabute Gilliman.
Where will they strike next? Demanded Vray Sire. Where on Briseis will they make their move?
Archivist Denier stared blankly up at the Firecast leader. There was only confusion and fear in the human's face.
It matters not, said O'Mayan. There is no action the Space Marines can take for which I have not laid the groundwork.
I can only hope you are correct, said Vray Sire, for the sake of my Firecast brethren. The Space Marines are few in number, but when they strike hard and focused for the maximum impact. The Hunter Carders have few counter-tactics to the Space Marines. It has been one of our greatest setbacks in the Third Sphere expansion. If we do not respect them, we are done for.
I respect them well enough, Shazray, said O'Mayan. It is for that reason I was sent to Briseis. We knew the Space Marines would be here. My task was to observe the city and all the possible paths a Space Marine operation in this city could take. Thus far, the Ultramarines and Jade Dragons have followed those paths as surely as if I myself was leading them. And I will lead them to the end of whatever path they will take, a path that leads only towards the greater good.
You make a tool of everything around you, Ambassador, said Vray Sire. Enemy and ally. It would not surprise me to learn that your fellow Tau were just instruments to you, to be used and disposed of as you will.
Not as I will, said O'Mayan smoothly. As the greater good demands of me.
The Tau reattached the archivist to his life support systems, ignoring his weak cries for mercy and death,
Soon the pipe was slid back down his throat, and he was silent. As Umayan and Vray Sire left the place, the silence was broken only by the ticking and bleeping of the machinery. The Codex Astartes was obscure on some points, ambiguous on others, but on the subject of surprise, it was clear. Tactical surprise is the greatest advantage any fighting force can have in war. An enemy fights two battles when he is taken by surprise. He must fight his own inertia, the chaos of sudden assault, the ancient instincts to flee or hide, even before he can take up arms and face any enemy. A space marine was not ideally suited to stealth, which any other soldier might use to claw back an edge of surprise. A space marine's sheer bulk made it almost impossible for him to hide or creep in silence, and the pride he took in his chapter meant that with few exceptions, he would not cover his colours with camouflage. The Codex therefore endorsed surprise by means of a rapid and furious assault from an unexpected angle, achieving with speed and suddenness what could not be achieved with silence. The Space Marines made use of the drop pod and gunship assault, the boarding torpedo, the armoured spearhead to snatch up the initiative and plunge an enemy into battle before that enemy knew it was being fought. Captain Davinius knew the Codex well. No ultramarine was ignorant of Gilliman's masterwork. And so it was that he crouched alongside the battle brothers of his squad on the Lev train as it thundered along the track, passenger stations and loading docks hurtling past through the strobing darkness. 3 minutes out, called Brother Silen, reading the transit system's schematics from his Auspex scanner. Unorthodox, Captain! I wonder if Gilliman envisioned this when he wrote. He imagined victory, said Davinius over the thundering of the passing structures and the howl of the Lev train's overcharged coils. And this is how we will win it. The squad was in the rearmost carriage of four, the front housing the powerful generator, which was being drained dry to force the train well past its maximum speed. According to the schematics, the train could not stay on its tracks if it maintained this speed when it hit the next major junction. Then again, reflected Davinius, this was Thaxos's idea. Would that he were here to see it, said Brother Morovos, whose plasma gun was slung so he could hold on to the railing beside him with both hands. He would have something clever to say about our chances. We fight this like any other battle, and our chances will be nil, shouted Davinius in reply. The Emperor demands victory. The Codex commands it. We will deliver. The train shrieked through a passenger station. The controls had been doctored and bypassed by Odorak, who, while not a tech marine, had a more than good enough head for technology. The citizens waiting on the platforms had expected the train to stop to pick them up. Instead, it shot past at tremendous speed, and they screamed as several were thrown off their feet by the gale that passed in the train's wake. Perhaps word would get out about the ultramarines in the rearmost carriage. It didn't matter. They had less than 30 seconds before they reached their target, and any warning would arrive far too late. Ahead, the junction approached, lit by warning lights flashing red. A terrible metallic scream filled the air as the train tried to take the next bend too quickly, and the magnetic clamps were torn off the rail, the train slewing onto one side as it arrowed onwards. Davinius kept his footing. A couple of the ultramarines lost their balance, grabbing onto a handhold before they were tumbled through one of the windows that shattered under the strain. The front carriage slammed into the wall of the tunnel. The wall collapsed, and the carriage was propelled into the rooms beyond it, masonry falling in the dark hail. With an awful sound of tearing metal, the front carriage was forced to a halt, embedded deep in the foundations of the building ahead. The second carriage buckled and crumpled to half its length, and the third fared little better. The fourth carriage was warped and twisted, but not enough to imperil the ultramarines still clinging on. No normal soldier would have countenanced it as a method of insertion. That was why the Ultramarines had used it to score tactical surprise against the enemy inside. Thus was the spirit of the Codex adhered to, if not its letter, as Captain Davinius led his squad through the wreckage and the rubble into the lower floors of the Generatorium. Sergeant Sianoa's totem was the flight, the swirling pack of predators that moved as one with the same purpose. That was how his squad moved, following him less by orders and more by instinct. Sianoa was a natural leader in the purest sense, born to be the head of the flight, born to be the first teeth into the prey. They broke into the open among the shanties at the foot of the Generatorium's great cooling towers, cloaked in the pollutant mists and the darkness where the complex's floodlights could not reach. The people who lived there shut themselves in, bolted their windows and doors, and hoped to survive until the sun came up. The jade dragons were angry ghosts breaching the surface of the night, and the ancient fears of Briseis's tribes spoke of such monsters rising from the slate wastes to mutilate and destroy. They were not far wrong. Sianoa led the squad up the lower levels of gantries, up towards the command catwalks, allowing maintenance access to the cooling towers. The walkways connected to the main building housing the turbine hall and command rooms. The workers who saw them fled, and not a shot had to be fired before the jade dragons reached the turbine hall itself. The Generatorium was at full capacity. The turbines roared, shuddering the web of catwalks high above the main hall. The first kill was one of the sentries who watched over the hall for xenophile saboteurs, sniped through the upper back with a stalker shell. His body fell several stories to the floor of the turbine hall and vanished between the huge cylindrical housings of the turbines. Two more died, one to Sianoa's own lightning claw. He didn't even activate the weapon's power field as he punched the weapon's curved blades through the sentry's back. The sentry wore the dark red uniform of men under the orders of the Adeptus Mechanicus and carried a lasgun he never had time to unsling. Sianoa kicked the body over the railing.
"There,"
he said, pointing towards one of the control rooms overlooking the turbine hall, a short sprint across the walkways.
"Expect resistance. Be swift and do not wait to see a weapon. Move, my brothers."
The 10-strong squad were hindered more by the size of their armored bodies in the narrow doorway than by the Generatorium workers manning the late shift in the control room. The shock on their faces was illuminated by the lights on the readouts and control panels lining the walls. Sianoa shot one with his bolt pistol, the customized weapon blowing a torso wide open with a fragmenting metal storm shell. It was overkill, but that was better than underkill. The jade dragons making their way into the room added their own fire, single bolter shots taking down the half-dozen workers in a few seconds. A Voxlink handset on the wall was untouched. None of the workers had time to grab it and raise the alarm. That was a minute or two more of time the jade dragons had bought with their speed and lack of mercy. That was how true predators won the day. Tagamala affixed a charge to the command room's back wall, magnetic clamps holding it to the control panel. The jade dragons backed up against the wall. Sianoa didn't have to say anything. His squadmates knew the plan well enough and filled their part in it like true flightmates. The charge went off, and the wall was blown inwards. Sianoa was through the breach before the debris hit the floor. Beyond, the architecture changed. The practical industrial face of the turbine hall was replaced with the religious overtones of the priesthood of Mars. Columns topped with half-skulls and cogs, shrines built into the walls with offerings of raw metal blocks and clockwork trinkets, machine-code prayers pinned to the walls. The air was thick with incense burning in the braziers that provided a guttering light. Sianoa didn't wait for his squad. They would be behind him. They always were. He forged through the Mechanicus chambers, passing by equipment rooms and laboratories where ornate crucibles burned exotic elements and generator towers spat arcs of electricity. The alarm had been raised. A klaxon blared somewhere. The Adeptus Mechanicus had brought in more men and armed them to defend this place in response to the xenophile presence in the city. Cianoa had seen the troop manifests, and he knew they would not be enough. Three troopers burst into the laboratory as Cianoa led the squad through it. Lazfire met him, and he dropped down behind one of the lab benches, the slab of solid bronze absorbing the fire. Boltafire streaked back across the room, and as the troops took cover, Cianoa vaulted the bench and fell among them. He shot one through the stomach and lashed through the other with his lightning claw. The power field activated this time and burst in a shower of light as it discharged through the second trooper, shredding his upper body and leaving nothing left above the mid-chest. The third trooper was shot down by a bolter round from the other jade dragons moving through the room. The firefight had lasted about 5 seconds. Ahead was the chapel, overlooked by a great altarpiece of the half-skull, a fat industrial diamond set into its eye, and the cog-half plated in brass. Columns of polished steel rose towards a vaulted ceiling covered in machine code script, zeros and ones mingling with equations picked out in Electrum. There, Major Skepteris was performing her prayers to the machine spirit of the Generatorium and the defense laser complex she watched over, and to the Omni-Sire of whose intellect they were all a part. She knelt before the altar and turned at the sound of the jade dragon's footsteps booming on the steel grill of the chapel floor. She still wore the hide of the Black Leviathan over her shoulders. The Magos stood as Cianoa crossed the chapel floor. The rest of the squad stood back. Their guns were ready, in case they were needed. But for now, this was their sergeant's fight.
"Why are you here?" demanded Skepteris. "This is a place of worship."
"I know what you worship," said Cianoa coldly. "And it is not the Omnisire. You may have fooled the Ultramarines, but we are not so stupid. The mark of the Black Leviathan is on you, heretic. As we hunt, so we are hunted. But sometimes fiat brings those that hunt us into our gun sights. And so you will die."
"I am loyal," said Skepteris. "I am dedicated to destroying the xenophiles and doing the Emperor's work."
"I care nothing for the xenophiles," said Cianoa. "Briseis and Agrellon can burn for all we care. Fate put us here to destroy you."
Cianoa pointed at Skepteris with the blades of his lightning claw, and the blue-white light of the power field flickered across the columns and the shadowy vault of the ceiling. Skepteris fought back. Her augmentations had enough combat capability to give her a good chance against xenophile assassins. Her mechadendrites whipped around Cianoa, who grabbed them in the crook of one elbow and twisted, throwing Skepteris to the ground like a wrestler. He slashed down at her with his claw, but she was faster than she looked, and rolled out of the way, the mechadendrites slithering out of Cianoa's grasp. Skepteris's jaw opened wide, too wide to be natural. Between her metal teeth emerged the barrel of a gun, the slotted heat dissipator of a melter weapon. She fired a bolt of superheated particles that burned a deep furrow through one of Cianoa's shoulder pads, scorching through the ceramite down to the bone. Cianoa roared and ducked behind a column, molten ceramite running down his side.
"What witchery has taken root on Briseis?" shouted Cianoa. "What dark god sent you here? You will answer the Emperor in hell."
Skepteris stood, the gun barrel withdrawing back down her throat. She turned to see the Jade Dragon's squad standing across the chapel, cutting off any escape. Every bolter barrel was aimed at her.
"I can kill one of you," said Skepteris, "but the chances are low, and then I will die. So there is no logic in resisting. Use no more of the Emperor's bullets on me than you have to."
She did not turn as Seer Noah walked up behind her, the power field crackling around his claw. He rammed the blades through her midriff, carving upwards through her chest and out through her upper back. Her head flopped forwards on its ruined neck, and Seer Noah caught her as she fell forwards. He slashed across her waist and cut her in two, shreds of burning robe and hide falling among the showering blood.
"I will waste no bullets on this creature," said Seer Noah,
dropping the upper half of Major Skepteris to the floor. The bodies formed a trail from the turbine hall to the chapel, marking out the progress of the jade dragons. Some of the bodies were still alive. By some fluke, their vital organs spared the bolter shrapnel, leaving blood loss and shock to finish the job. One of them, a peacemaker soldier, dragged himself on bloody hands into the command room. The place was choked with smoke from the charge that had blown the wall out, and draped with the bodies of the workers who had died there with no idea why. The floor was slick with blood, and the trooper's hands slipped in it as he dragged himself forwards. He reached one of the control consoles. Lights still winked on its readouts. He grabbed the ankle of the body lying over the controls and pulled it away, letting it flop to the floor. A handset came away with the body, dangling by a wire, and the trooper held it to his face.
"Whoever hears," gasped the trooper, "what brothers there are out there! I know one of you must hear me! The generatorium! They're hitting the generatorium! Tell the ambassadors! Tell everyone! For the greater good!"